Law school application volume has been in a tailspin since the financial crisis. Does this decline in interest and competition represent an opportunity or a threat for law school applicants? We'll discuss that with our guest, who is an expert in legal education and the co-founder of Law School Transparency. Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can high-five the person next to you and shout, "Yes, I'm in." Now, I first learned about law school transparency in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 and the implosion of the legal job market. Law School Transparency was doing some great work in highlighting the lack of transparency among law schools in connection with hiring and placement of their grads. I recently again read about Law School Transparency in terms of law school admissions, dropping LSAT scores, and plunging bar passage rates. I'm thrilled to have Kyle McKenty, co-founder and executive director of Law School Transparency, on the show today. Kyle earned his bachelor's at UNC Chapel Hill, and then went to Vanderbilt for law school. But a funny thing happened on the way to his earning his JD. He co-founded Law School Transparency, and we're going to learn the rest of the story right now. Kyle, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thanks, Linda. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm delighted to speak with you. Can you give us the backstory to Law School Transparency? Why did you found it?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was applying to law school way back in 2007, I was having a difficult time choosing among three law schools, Vanderbilt, Cornell, and the University of Texas. Mm-hmm. And as I was exploring those schools, I really wanted to choose Vanderbilt, a school that places well in the Southeast and has a great reputation down here, and that's where I wanted to go work. But on the other hand, Cornell was highly ranked in U.S. News rankings, and it was an Ivy League school.
Right.
And that's tough to pass up. And so as I was applying, though, and going through the process, I was at the admitted students weekend at Vanderbilt, and the school actually shared this list of where all the graduates from 2007 went to go work. And I thought this list was incredible, and so did my co-founder, Patrick Lynch, who at the time was a 1L at Vanderbilt. And so with this list, what I did was put together a spreadsheet that analyzed it and really dove into what the employment outcomes of Vanderbilt were. And Patrick and I got to talking and said, well, why don't other schools do this? I mean, for me, I looked at this list and said, okay, I can envision myself in a lot of these different jobs, and therefore I'm comfortable choosing Vanderbilt because it's in a better place for me, it's a slightly better price, and I just all around can be more comfortable with a school that's being more transparent about their job outcomes. Mm-hmm. So Patrick and I got talking. We said, okay, why don't other schools do this? We should try and get them to do it. And then as we started to look into the reasons, we uncovered that law schools were, by and large, providing deceptive employment statistics for prospective current students.
In what way?
And we decided that basically what they would do is they would advertise an employment rate of, say, 95-98%, but mm-hmm. they would not disclose that this number included all sorts of jobs, from a lawyer at a large firm to part-time document review to a barista okay. at Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when someone looks at – yeah, exactly. So schools would also provide – salaries that looked really great. So they'd say, oh, well, our median salary is $160,000. But they wouldn't disclose that 10% of the class responded to the survey, and therefore only 5% of the class is actually making that amount of money.
Got it.
And so we decided this is unacceptable. This needs to change. We founded Law School Transparency, and it really all snowballed from there.
That's amazing. Now, are the schools doing better now in terms of providing these statistics? I'm thinking in my mind, let's say, about MBA career employment reports, where they say how many people were looking for a job, how many people, how many people went into consulting, the average salary in consulting. I'm not saying they're perfect, but they have a council with standards for reporting that they're supposed to adhere to. Is there anything that's developed along those lines for law schools?
Yeah, so one of the things is that the legal profession, and the ABA in particular, has been really ahead of the curve in terms of disclosure. Okay. Now, early on, the disclosures were junk and mm-hmm. allowed for the schools to do what I was just describing.
Mm-hmm.
But back in 2010, we published a white paper that outlined what we wanted and how we wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. And so we convinced the American Bar Association, which is the accreditor of law schools, to adopt new rules. And so at this point now, law schools are doing much better because they have to, because the ABA now requires that they publish certain information.
And that was a result of your work.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
And then on top of that, schools now provide information voluntarily. And we have about 60% of law schools participating in what we request every year. And so that's also a huge change. And so what we've seen is going from bad information to just a lot of good information. And information is really powerful, both in terms of the raw data as well as the narratives that develop around those data.
Sure. What do you think they still need to do?
Or
do
you think that
in terms of transparency? Yeah, employment transparency, exactly.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see 100% of schools participating
sure.
in the normative disclosures. Right now, what we ask is that schools publish their NALP report, which is a really handy report that the National Association of Law Professionals provides to the school every year about their graduates.
Uh-huh.
It's a PDF they receive in their inbox, and all they have to do is forward it to LST, and we can publish it and put it in our database. But a lot of schools are still choosing against doing that.
I see. Now, from LST's 2015 State of Legal Education Report, it appears that your focus has shifted a little bit from what happens after law school to who is being admitted to law school, and what's kind of happened with the inputs as opposed to the outputs, from jobs to bar passage. Is it really a shift or merely an extension of your earlier focus?
Oh, it's definitely an extension of our earlier focus. I mean, our mission is to make entry to the legal profession more transparent, affordable, and fair. And there's just a ton of stuff wrapped into this. And mm-hmm. what we're dealing here with is fundamentally a fairness issue. And what we've seen is an unfortunate, nasty consequence of transparency is that law schools now are desperate for students.
Right.
And it's making it easier for people to get in that may face significant hurdles to actually ever practicing law.
I didn't like summarize the findings of that 2015 State of Legal Education Report. Can you summarize it briefly for listeners? Because we're kind of talking about it and they may not know what it was, what it showed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the gist of it is that we were looking at a fall in admissions numbers.
Right.
Namely, the fall in LSAT scores, which is the admissions test for law school, and then undergraduate GPAs. And we asked, is this decline a problem? And if so, how much of a problem is it? And so what we did was analyze all of these admissions numbers in the context of completing school and passing the bar exam. Because if you want to practice law, you have to pass the bar exam.
And complete the
And
school.
So exactly. And so what we did is we analyzed all schools' performance is not quite the right word, but all schools entering classes and their students' performance on the LSAT and in undergrad. And it turns out that these are the two most significant predictors of your ability to pass the bar exam. And the LSAT, at least, is statistically significant in terms of its predictive value. And so when we're dealing with whole populations, if we see the cohort group become more risky, we can expect their bar exam outcomes to worsen.
Of course.
And we've already started to see the impact of that over the last few years. And the next 2 years are going to be significantly worse.
Didn't Bloomberg have like a major article about this, I think, about 6 months ago, an expose to a certain extent, that
yes.
I think the law schools were screaming that the bar has gotten harder and the woman in charge of the bar exam. I forget her name.
Erica Moser.
Right. And she was just saying, you know, forget it. The people you're sending to take the bar are not of the same caliber.
Exactly. And Erica is exactly right on this. The bar exam, there's a lot of science that goes into the development of the bar exam and ensuring that administrations over time are comparable over time. And it's the same science that goes into the LSAT. And so schools would are screaming about this, but they're not screaming as much anymore. There was a mishap in 2014 with ExamSoft, which is the software that people use to take the bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
And there were arguments put forth that caused a decline in the scores. And even if it's only by a point or two, that decline would have been a meaningful decline. But when the 2015 results started rolling out and we saw that the scores were falling across the board above and beyond what they were in 2014, those voices kind of faded into the distance.
Right. I had several years ago, it's probably 10 years ago, so it was before the financial crisis of 2008 and before the decline in legal hiring. I was interviewed by a reporter, and I believe what was going on was some law schools were being sued by some former students, not because they hadn't passed the bar, but because they hadn't completed school. They had low LSAT scores, and they hadn't completed school, and they were being sued for fraud by the applicants. Now, at that point, the dropout rate was stated on the site.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot also of controversy about schools over-relying on LSAT scores in admissions and that having a detrimental effect on diversity in the classrooms.
Absolutely.
So the reporter was asking me, what did I feel about this lawsuit and, you know, its chances and stuff. And I said, well, you know, one of the impacts is going to be is that there's going to be a chilling effect in terms of schools being willing to take a chance on people with low LSAT scores. And the schools at the bottom of the chain are basically giving these people a chance at pursuing a legal career. Now, obviously, your point, and it's very well taken, and I'm a big believer in kind of looking beyond the end of your nose, like a few years down, especially when you're talking about the expense of a law school degree, is if you can't pass the bar anyways, if the LSAT has a function not just in terms of being a gatekeeper and getting into law school, but it's predictive of what's going to happen later, then maybe it should be given more credence. Or how do you balance that, you know, that whole access and diversity issue with the bar passage rates?
Yeah, well, I think it's incredibly important to wrestle with and confront head on. The legal profession has an enormous problem with diversity, both in terms of ethnic and racial diversity, as well as the opportunities for women to assume leadership roles within the profession. And so anytime we're talking about the entry to the profession, we have to be concerned about ensuring that the profession actually looks like society, because it has major implications for access to justice, and access to justice is critical for any society that depends on the rule of law.
Right.
And so the real question then is, how do you balance opportunity with consumer protection?
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we've wrestled with in this report. And what it comes down to is law schools, they're taking unjust risks on people who end up paying for their more likely to succeed peers. In other words, if you just sneak into a school, you're less likely to get a scholarship. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you're paying more than the people who got a scholarship. And it's your tuition dollars that are going to paying for that scholarship. And so what we end up with is this really unjust system where the poor subsidize the rich. And here, we don't necessarily mean poor or rich by socioeconomic status, but in terms of expected outcomes.
Right.
And so it's not lost on me that we have a diversity issue, but we're not helping anyone if we're setting them up to fail.
Agreed. And what part do you feel, now, if you put all this data out there and somebody has an LSAT, whether they're rich or poor, that's, let's say, under 150. So they're in the gray zone. They're in the danger zone, let's say. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're, I don't know, maybe their GPA is more decent, but their LSAT is in this danger zone. The information now is out there that they're at risk of not, even if they go to law school and they put all the time and the money and the effort in, they're at serious risk of not being able to pass the bar. Do they at that point, would you say at that point that they just need to take responsibility for their decisions and the outcome? Because now the data is out there.
I mean, this comes back to the consumer protection, and it's tough to fault anyone for simply wanting to make their lives better.
No, not fault them. Better. Right. I'm not faulting anybody. I'm trying to wonder, I'm trying to ask, at what point does the consumer, at this point the student, mm-hmm. all right, they're an intelligent adult, and they know that their bar passage rate, their LSAT score would indicate that they have a low chance of taking the bar. Should they still try for law school, knowing the risks, or should they just say, you know, maybe I'll go do something else? What would you say to that person?
Yeah, I think it's tough to generalize. Okay. And the reason is that the bar exam, based on where you are in the country, mm-hmm. differs in difficulty.
True.
And so if you are looking at a state, like let's say South Carolina, that mm-hmm. has a really low cut score, mm-hmm. the cut score is basically the minimum passing threshold for passing the bar exam.
Okay.
And you compare that to, say, a state like California, which has right. the second highest in the country in terms of cut scores.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have, let's say, a 150 or 149, you are going to be a lot better off in South Carolina than you are in California. So if you're in California, you have to think a lot more carefully about your ability to pass the bar exam. Whereas mm-hmm. in South Carolina, you still have to think about it, but your odds go up.
Sure.
And you can also mitigate that risk besides the state you take it in if you have a high GPA.
Right.
And so if you are 3.8 and you went to a very good university like Duke, for example, that you know prepares you well for the challenges ahead of you, that's one thing. But if you went to a school where maybe it's not known as being as rigorous and you end up with, let's say, like a 2.9 GPA, you might be able to get into some schools in some places, but all of these things point to a significant risk of not being able to achieve what you went to there to do.
Right. No, I think these are excellent points. Now, I was poking around on Law School Transparency site, on the site, and there is absolutely fantastic data by school with GPA trends, costs, and much, much more. Is this data that is provided to you by the schools, by the ABA, by students?
It's a combination.
Okay.
There is no data from students,
okay.
except insofar that there is data about students provided to the schools, which then provided to us. But almost all of the data there comes from the ABA or law schools, with some data coming from U.S. News and some data being generated by us. For example, the financial information. We take the inputs from the schools, the cost of attendance, the tuition trends over the years, and then we apply an algorithm to it to project a cost estimate to help them derive how much they'll actually owe in under certain scenarios if they have to borrow to attend law school. And that's how much they would owe the day of their first payment, which is about 6 months after graduation.
Right. I've mentioned
this. By and large, the data come from schools and the ABA.
Okay. All right. That sounds great. I mentioned this on the show before. At one time, our eldest son was considering going to law school. This was before the financial crisis. He was considering going to law school, and my husband and I were not willing to foot the bill for him to do so. So we said, how do you intend to pay for it? We didn't think he was that serious about it. We just thought he wanted to postpone becoming an adult. And we said to him, how do you intend to pay for it? He says, oh, I'll borrow. And we said, really? Do you know? He says, I can borrow. I said, do you know how much it's going to cost you? He says, yeah, you can borrow. And I said, well, you're looking at $50,000 a year. That'll be $150,000. He says, well, I can pay it back after I become a lawyer. And we said, do you know what the payment is? And we said, no. So we calculated the payment for him. My husband is an actuary. He can do this very easily. And his eyes got big. He had absolutely no clue what it would cost him on a monthly basis after law school. He realized it was like another rent. And
he and never went. In a lot of cases.
Yeah. And depending upon where you live. We are in Southern California. So the rent is high. But cost of living is high. But he never went to law school. He's doing very well professionally. And I have nothing against law school. If I had thought that he was serious about it and really preparing for it, we probably would have been at least a little bit more supportive. We just felt he was going for the wrong reasons. And so therefore we took the position we took. But I'm sure that there are others out there. I don't think my son is unique. And it's the wrong reason to go to law school, and they don't have a clue as to what it costs. And anybody listening who is considering law school, I strongly encourage you to explore law school transparency. There's fantastic data on that site. Hopefully the law schools will soon be providing it, and then you won't need a third party, but it's easy to compare there. Really, really useful, well laid out, well designed. And Kyle, I believe you're the one behind all that, aren't you?
Yes. So I programmed it, designed it, do most of the data entry. It's a fun job, that's for sure.
Okay, great. Now
I think you're exactly right though about the importance of understanding your costs.
Right.
And so easy to overlook it because someone's willing to lend you the money to do it.
Yes.
But you can borrow any amount as long as the school says from the federal government, and there are no questions asked. So someone's not evaluating your risk and saying, oh, this person will be able to repay it. That just isn't part of the calculation. And it's by design of the student loan program.
Right.
And so that's something that's on the back of every student to make sure that they do their due diligence on. And the tools we have do help people along that and along those lines and help them produce information that actually is relevant to them. And if you create an account on LST, you can actually customize all of the financial information and make your inputs of how much you're going to spend on housing, how much you think tuition is going to go up, and all those sorts of factors that go into figuring out how much am I going to owe and will I be able to afford this payment and do I want to afford to pay this payment. That's also, I think, what's lost sometimes. It's you might be able to say, get a good job and make $75,000 a year and get by and make your full payment. But do you want to just get by or do you want something more?
Right.
And those are difficult questions that are tough for people to wrestle with when they're just excited about the prospect of going to a new school and doing something new and doing something important. And that's the legal profession. It's incredibly important. And the work that we do in the profession is incredibly important. So it's understandable that people get so excited, but it's helpful to take a step back.
I think there also was, I think this is changing now, but for decades, law school was considered a good foundation for something or other. Didn't necessarily know what it was a good foundation for, but it was a good foundation. And you do learn a lot of good things in terms of careful writing and a certain form of analysis, and it is valuable. But what has changed is the cost.
Right.
And now also what's changed is employability. And just to piggyback off what you were saying, a lot of people go to law school, they assume the debt, and they assume and maybe they can get a job with big law. But then they must get a job with big law in order to pay the debt. And they can't leave. And they may not be happy.
Right. And then
that happens a lot too.
Right, and they're going to leave within 3 or 4 years on average because people just don't last in
right.
big law because it's up or out in many cases, or in other cases, they just choose against the lifestyle of a big firm lawyer. And it's for good reason because it sucks the soul out of people, and I've seen it happen to my friends, and I hate watching it.
Right. One of our consultants who is a lawyer, she's actually a Harvard Law grad, I was corresponding with her, and I mentioned that I'm going to be talking to you today. And her comment was, why look at bar passage rates? Law schools don't prepare you for bar passage. Now, I realized, and my response to her was, well, if you want to be a lawyer, you got to pass the bar. So if you can't pass the bar, you know, like the head bone's connected to neck bone. And we kind of jokingly said, well, I guess if you get a high LSAT and then go to a good bar review course, what do you need law school for? How did you choose bar passage because it is just a necessity? It is a necessity. And yet law schools don't really prepare you for bar passage.
Well, I don't think that's quite fair because I think a lot of schools do.
Okay.
But Harvard doesn't, because Harvard doesn't need to, because the students that Harvard has all scored in the high 160s or 170s.
Okay.
And you have a few people coming under that, but by and large, these are the smartest people in the country who have worked hard their entire lives.
Right.
So, of course, Harvard doesn't need to spend time helping them with a standardized test that they figured out how to master in high school.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Now, what are you most proud of in your work with law school transparency?
Oh, that's a good question.
You have a lot to be proud of. There's no question.
Well, I don't know if I believe there is a lot to be proud of, but it's tough to pinpoint one thing because I kind of all seeing it relate together.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that the legal profession is critical to a functioning democracy.
Absolutely.
And I view what law schools have been doing over the years as just chipping away at the trust that lawyers need to operate in that space. And the more difficult it is for us lawyers to operate with the trust of society, the worse outcomes we can expect from a rule of law perspective. And so I think anything that I've done that has any implication towards advancing the rule of law is something I'm extraordinarily proud of. And I think we've done that. And, you know, it's painful right now for legal education. People are losing their jobs at law schools, and no one wants to see that happen. But it's a necessary correction to get us back on track to providing the public service that we need to provide for the profession and then to society. And so, again, it just comes back to anything I can do that's contributing to that overall mission of strengthening the legal profession, that I'm proud of.
That's great. What are your plans for law school transparency? Any plans to expand it to business schools, who I actually think are doing a fairly good job, not perfect, but good, medical schools or perhaps PhD programs, which definitely could use some transparency?
Yeah, I don't have any plans for that. We are already resource dry, I would say.
Okay.
It's tough raising money around these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm always talking to people about from other industries about what they can do to, you know, enhance transparency and enforce accountability across mm-hmm. their stated segment. But beyond that, consulting and, you know, help on the side, I feel less passionate about it. And I didn't always have the passion. I mean, to start, I just saw a problem and decided, I'll fix it. And then the passion developed because people were fighting back against something that was so simple as to be infuriating that anyone would fight back against it.
Right.
And so maybe that would happen with other areas, but there's just too much to do within the legal profession, and people don't understand the legal ecosystem. And so anything LSC is going to do going forward has to do with strengthening the profession and helping people better understand the roles that legal professionals play within that legal ecosystem. And a lot of that comes down to figuring out how to communicate qualitative information to people so that way they can act on it and use it to their benefits and to society's benefit.
What advice would you have for people considering a law school education? What would you have?
Know what you're getting into.
Okay.
Yeah, know what you're getting into and make sure that you understand not just the statistics, but why you want to do it in the first place and whether it's a good match for your skills and your personality. We are increasingly seeing that working for a smaller firm, which is what the vast majority of lawyers do,
mm-hmm.
That it's running a small business that happens to do legal services as opposed to the traditional profession that people think of it as. And that's not a good or bad thing, but it means that the people who join the profession need to be prepared for the business side of it.
Right.
And law schools are doing a better job at preparing people for that. But, you know, they're a little behind the curve, and there's, you know, for-profit companies, LexisNexis, Westlaw, others that are getting in the game to help people better manage the law practice side of things, the business side of things. But this is the same transition that dental schools went through a while back, because they found that so many people at dental schools were opening up their own shops that they didn't know what they were doing when it was time to, you know, deal with the accountants or...
Right. Well, MBA programs have grown fantastically in the last 20 years.
Right, absolutely. And so I think that if you want to consider law school and pursuing a legal education and becoming a lawyer, just understand what the profession looks like now and what it's likely to look like in the future. And again, that's not a good or bad thing. It's just trying to figure out, does this match my expectations, both from a financial perspective and from a personal satisfaction perspective, as well as a career development perspective.
What should applicants look at when choosing schools?
In terms of resources or general?
I'm an applicant. I'm trying to choose where to apply. How do I choose?
I would say step one is to go to lawschooltransparency.com. Okay. And I say that not to give us a plug, but because...
I already plugged you. You're okay.
we've designed the site to help people with that exact decision. Mm-hmm. And we have a guide on there that says, which school should I apply to?
Okay.
And really what it comes down to is trying to identify what you want and then identifying the schools that help best meet those needs and then figuring out whether you can get in those schools and whether you can afford it. And it's a long process of starting with all schools and kind of narrowing down to the schools that will best meet your needs and do so effectively. But it really all starts with focusing on you and what you want out of your degree. And if you don't know, then maybe it's not time to go to law school.
Excellent. I'm jumping up and down here. I think it's so important that applicants in general, law school applicants specifically, do something to familiarize themselves with what they're getting into, right? So shadow a lawyer, get a part-time job in a legal office, work in a legal clinic, do something that allows you to get a sense of what you're going to be doing and make sure it's something you're going to enjoy.
Absolutely. And we actually, so last year, I'd say last May or so, so this is May 2014, I was using our website, the LSD scoreboards, mm-hmm. and I saw all these mountains of data, really helpful information if you know what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why did I put my list together of where all the people went to work when I was applying to Vanderbilt or choosing Vanderbilt? Mm-hmm. And I said it was because I really just didn't know what I wanted to do, and I just had no guidance. And so I said, am I really helping people with this site right now who don't have that guidance? And the answer was no. And so we developed a podcast called I Am the Law that provides qualitative information through informational interviews with practicing lawyers. Because not only is it important to go find a lawyer shadow, but it's important for us as an organization to provide the resources for the people who don't know many or any lawyers, or who don't know what questions they'd even ask if they manage to sit down with them. And particularly for people from disadvantaged backgrounds, it's difficult to feel that empowerment, to know what questions to ask or even feel like you can ask anyone questions in the first place. And so I think that's really important for other professions to learn from. It's how do we get that qualitative information into the hands of the people who need it, so that way we get the people who can best serve our clients in the future.
That's true. Now, you've been running Law School Transparency. Is that a full-time occupation for you?
It is. So I've been running it full-time since 2009, but I graduated law school in 2011.
I see. So you actually haven't practiced law, right?
I had a year fellowship.
Oh, all right.
Right after law school that I worked for a nonprofit that does legal services for other nonprofits. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know.
But this is your passion. This is what you love. This is what you
love. It is. I really love what I'm doing now. It's fun. It's impactful.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I can see the results, which helps. But that's the thing about working in the nonprofit world. It's, you don't always see your results right away, and I'm spoiled in that regard.
Well, again, I want to I'm a big fan. I think your work is very valuable. You've done a great job of getting information out there to applicants that they need to have. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. You've been doing wonderful work. Your site is an invaluable resource for law school applicants. Where can applicants learn more about your work? And you mentioned your podcast. Can you provide some URLs?
Yeah, absolutely. So lawschooltransparency.com is our website. And from there, you can find access to all of our resources. You can follow us on Twitter at LSTUpdates. And then you can find our podcast on iTunes. It's called I Am the Law, a Judge Dredd reference. And you can also find the podcast on virtually every podcatcher app out there. Okay. I personally use Stitcher and like it, even if the audio quality is not quite up to my standards.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll include links to all these resources at info.exhibit.com/128 to everything that Kyle just mentioned. Kyle, thanks again. Listener, again, you can find the resources at info.exhibit.com/128. And I want to thank you for tuning in to this, our 128th episode. If you found this show helpful, then I'd like to suggest that maybe you should subscribe. And yes, we too are on a whole bunch of podcasters, specifically iTunes, Stitcher, or Zune. So you don't need to miss any of the upcoming shows. We have shows focused on admissions practices at specific schools and for specific degrees. We have shows on test prep, career guidance, financial aid, and much more, anything that's of interest to graduate school applicants. So don't miss anything, don't miss any shows, and subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, or Zune. We have subscribe links in the show notes at info.accepted.com/128. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.